I spent 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years with someone that I thought I did it. I thought I broke the generational cycle. And the truth is, you just repeated it.
In a different way.
In a different way. Right. But still unhealthy.
You set me up for this. Like this, I just repeated what I thought was normal. And of course you don't believe that he's so terrible because you guys normalized it for me. And I think about this in terms of single moms going back into the dating pool, or if they want to start over and have more children, you know, it's a risk no matter what you do. Being a single mom without a man in the home is a risk, safety wise and financially, but also bringing men around your children, also a safety risk. I mean, there's
huge risk, huge risk.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And no one likes to talk about that, but I've seen some pretty horrific cases where the kids are killed by the step-parent or the new boyfriend or the new girlfriend.
Pregnancy and postpartum are two of the times in a woman's life where she's most likely to figure out she's in an abusive relationship because her partner's like, I don't need to try anymore. She's locked in. I can abuse her and exploit her. What's she going to do, leave me? Yeah, right.
But make sure that no matter what, even if you decide to be the stay-at-home parent, that you're not the stuck stay-at-home parent.
I remember my ex-husband taking the car battery out of my vehicle so I couldn't leave him. So there was a lot of financial abuse that I saw once I started talking about it. I saw a lot of other women have similar experiences. And I thought, once I get out of this and I get to a place of more financial stability, I have a husband, we have more kids, I want to give back and help women get out of that too. And money is freedom. And when a woman doesn't have her own income or her own access to money, or even if she's not working, if her husband's not funding an account in her name that she can have full control over, she doesn't have many options.
You can say, well, that's nice tone meter, but I'm still sending the message that says F you, you MF-er, and I hate you, and I hope you crawl back into your spider hole, shrivel up, and die. That's actually a message.
That sounds like it was shared from our group chat on the Locks.
Probably. I think that's one you sent me, actually.
This got dark really fast.
This took a left turn on Memorial Day weekend. The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Lovelust Law. Today, we are joined by Emily Rose Chadwick. She's a business owner, survivor, mom, homesteader, writer, and the founder of the Mama Wilder Foundation, a nonprofit that provides cash grants to women navigating the family court system. She launched the organization in 2021 after beginning to use her platform to raise funds for women facing crises similar to those she had personally navigated. Following her own experiences in family and criminal court, she has continued building a life centered around her family. She holds a BA in Women and Gender Studies and uses her platform to educate audiences on coercive control, financial abuse, and the importance of women's autonomy in healthcare decisions. Boy, this is going to be a great one because so much of what you talk about is kind of what I talk about. So welcome, Emily. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm dying to know, and I'm sure the audience will too, that doesn't know you, how did you get into this? Like, what's your journey to your foundation?
We created this 501c3 when I met my husband. He was actually a prosecutor at the time, and I was coincidentally going through a felony criminal case as the victim. And he was a baby lawyer just right out of law school, and I was a single mom just going through both family court and criminal court. And we were both left with a really sour taste in our mouths from going through the criminal court process. And there were a lot of, I should say, the DA's office just really let us down in many ways. And so I got to see firsthand the gaps in resources and help for women. And I like to think that I can articulate myself and I can communicate and advocate for myself. And I thought, well, if I'm having a hard time, what about all these other women who don't have the same background or privilege that I do? And at the time, I had been fundraising for women on the internet using my social media page for a couple of years, kind of informally. And in fact, one of the first things that my now husband said when he heard about this was, we need to figure that out for taxes because you're just collecting money for people. So, I mean, he's like the legal side of it. So we sought 501c3 status. We were approved. And like we were talking about briefly before we started recording, we don't take government funds. So we haven't been really affected by any shutdowns or any lapse in funding through the state. So we are donation based. We take funds from my social media, the passive monetization tools that I'm sure you know about. So we're really lucky in that we can keep giving out these grants to women who, you know, just need some help making rent for the month or getting groceries or renting a car or plane tickets. We don't fund family law retainers, which I would love to in the future, but we don't want to get involved in that. And we have, you know, we have our bylaws and our rules for what our limits are, but it's really, we try to be, you know, just the quick, I need like $500 just to get me from A to B. And that amount of money, like now, seems small because I'm out of that. But when you're in it, $500, $750, $1,000 can be life-changing for these women, especially the stay-at-home moms. And, you know, to answer your original question, how did I do this? I was that stay-at-home mom. I had two little girls. I lived on a farm in Delta County, Colorado. I remember my ex-husband taking the car battery out of my vehicle so I couldn't leave him. So there was a lot of financial abuse that I saw once I started talking about it. I saw a lot of other women have similar experiences. And I thought, once I get out of this and I get to a place of more financial stability, I have a husband, we have more kids, I want to give back and help women get out of that too. What I've also experienced and I've observed in other women is a lot of times when women get out of these toxic relationships, they have so often a falling out with their families of origin, with their parents, because they realize, oh, you set me up for this. Like this, I just repeated what I thought was normal. And of course you don't believe that he's so terrible because you guys normalized it for me. Like it's so isolating and lonely for a lot of these people getting out of these terrible relationships, because you have this aha moment of, oh my God, I repeated what I thought was normal. And yep. Look where it got me. I mean, I know that the choices I made in my relationships are because I had a pretty messed up family of origin and the dynamics I witnessed and repeated. And that took me a long time to really come to terms with and understand my role in this, because I repeated what I thought it was normal. And
so I spent 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years with someone that I thought I did it. I thought I broke the generational cycle. And the truth is, you just repeated it.
In a different way.
In a different way. Right. But still unhealthy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough to break that family of origin upbringing, because as a child, you learn to function pretty well within that chaos or that dysfunction. And so because you know how to navigate it, you look to recreate it in your own life, because you're like, well, I navigated it back then and survived it. And you think your childhood was pretty good, you know, for the most part, and you have good memories. So, okay, well, let's go ahead and recreate what I know was chaotic, but worked for whatever reason, because I'm still here. Survival. I'm still functioning and I'm, you know, an adult. But yeah, it's, you know, I hate to say youth is truly wasted on the youth. But to some extent, it really is, because you're not sophisticated enough to understand this until you get older, number one, because you actually have had to live some life to understand it. Because when people like any of us are telling the younger people, hey, watch out for this, watch out for this, this is a red flag, they're like, you don't know what you're talking about. I remember having a conversation with my stepdaughter when her boyfriend sold his car, so they were down to one vehicle. And that, in my book, is one of the biggest red flags, because you are creating dependence for everything in that couple, from getting to work, grocery shopping, doing anything. It is, you go get onto one car and someone's driving you everywhere. We got a problem. And so, and she's like, oh, no, it's just so we can make better ends meet and whatever else. It's not like that. And let's just say they were cops called numerous times thereafter and some domestic violence arrests made down the road. And so it was exactly what I thought it was, but she wasn't going to hear any part of that from me at the age she was at, because she knew better. And so I don't know how we get around that part of it. Any suggestions?
I'm really not the one to ask, because I was headstrong and no one could tell me shit when I was 16, 17. I mean, I had a baby at 22. Like, that was... you know, we look for love in all the wrong places, but also being a headstrong, and I was the eldest daughter. I look at my eldest daughter and I'm like, oof, I hope that you don't take after your mom. I hope you can listen and actually hear me.
Oh, no. When I say headstrong, it was don't tell me I can't do it. Don't tell me how to do it. And I got this. And I think my stepdad called me a bull in a china shop. And I don't think that has ever changed, ever. And you couldn't have told me otherwise. Like, I know when I married my ex-husband, my parents were very much like, how do we slow this down? How do we slow this down? How do we slow this down? And because I'm guessing they saw all the red flags. I'm sure my mom did particularly. And my response was, no, let's just speed it up.
Yeah, I understand that. But love is always a risk. And I think about this in terms of single moms going back into the dating pool, or if they want to start over and have more children. You know, it's a risk no matter what you do. Being a single mom without a man in the home is a risk, safety-wise and financially, but also bringing men around your children, also a safety risk. I mean, there's...
Huge risk.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yes.
And it's because, and here's what happens, and this goes back to biology, is that you get more children injured by the new stepdad, boyfriend, whatever, because they aren't the biological offspring, and that new person wants to make room for theirs. I mean, it sounds awful, but a lot of it's biology 101.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. That's the animal kingdom.
It's the animal kingdom. And no one likes to talk about that, but I've seen some pretty horrific cases where the kids are killed by the step-parent or the new boyfriend or the new girlfriend. And so there's risks associated with every facet of getting back into the dating pool, which is interesting because I think one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was getting back into the dating world. Like, do you do it? Why? Like, modern dating, you know, I got divorced after being married for 22 years. I was with my ex-husband for 24 years. And the last time I dated was like 1999, right?
Times have changed.
Times have changed substantially.
It just goes back to that idea that it's always a risk. Like, you know, there's that social media trend where these women they're sort of praising their husbands. Like, yeah, my husband's not a loser. I didn't marry a loser. I don't know if you've seen that trend on TikTok. It sounds like these women are praising their husbands by saying, yeah, I married a really great guy. But they're at the same time dogging women who ended up finding out that their husbands were not great guys. And there's this, like, we just want to blame people for their own mistreatment and their own abuse. And that's not helpful to anyone. And so that really just rubbed me the wrong way. And when you ask me, how do I know that my current husband's not like the last one? Anyone at any point can disappoint me and come home, and I can find out my husband is, you know, addicted to porn, or he's got a girlfriend or another child. So, like, that is not out of the realm of possibilities for anyone. So the difference is my life set up in a way where I'm just as vulnerable as I was last time? Absolutely not. You know, I remember when I had our older son. He was like, I want to fund a spousal Roth IRA for you. And I want to make it so that you actually have things that I talk about on social media. He's like, I want that to be something that you are able to do. And so it's just, I'm having different conversations with my husband that I never had with my first husband, because he also came from a different country with very different backgrounds and different value systems. And so, you know, it's just always a risk. But the question is, am I shit out of luck this time if for some reason this guy does have a mask that falls? I like to think I'm in a much better situation now than I was years ago when I tried this the first time.
See, and I think that's actually a really smart perspective, because you're taking into consideration that anyone can be fooled. Even the second time around or third time around, you think this one's different, right? Anyone can be fooled. But you've positioned yourself in a place where even if you are wrong and the mask falls off, you are not in the vulnerable position that you were in before. And I think that's really key. And that also, I think, makes you less likely to be a victim, because you have one, that confidence to know I'm not putting up with your crap. I'm not stuck with you, right? Like, you want to be a bonehead, go be a bonehead somewhere else, right? Yeah. But it puts you in a different mindset and perspective and puts you on solid footing where you're confident in who you are and what you're doing. And I think that's the lesson that we should try and teach the younger generation, which is be in love, have a great time, take the risks, right? Because falling in love and making a commitment with someone is a risk, no matter how sure you are about it. It's just an absolute risk. But make sure that no matter what, even if you decide to be the stay-at-home parent, that you're not the stuck stay-at-home parent.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know, that was a conversation when I was younger.
Again, I mean, it was such a risk to get involved with anyone and risk bringing that into my life, given that I had made such a terrible series of choices prior, that to try to trust myself again, or even to begin with, and risk opening my family up to that was so, it was just, it's always a gamble. And I feel really lucky that it worked out the way it did, because it could have gone the opposite direction.
How long were you single between your divorce and the current, like your marriage now?
My marriage?
Yeah.
I was, when I left him, it was about 2 years, which is very short, admittedly. I acknowledge that was short. I think my story is so, I got lucky for a lot of reasons. I ended up with a guy with no full siblings and an inheritance. I mean, like, who's an attorney?
Yeah, you hit the jackpot, right? And he's nice, a good dad, a good man.
He adopted my eldest. He married me the day after my ex was acquitted, actually. So yeah, it was romantic.
So can we talk? Do you mind talking a little bit about the criminal system and the acquittal and how that affected you?
That was probably the most jarring thing that had happened to me up until that point, because it seemed like such a shoo-in. And let me back up. I had a baby in college who, she didn't have a dad. And so I was a vulnerable single mom when I married my first husband. And my first husband was older. He knew I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom with my baby. He knew I really valued motherhood and being around for my children. And so he didn't have to try very hard to be everything I wanted when I told him straight up, this is what I want. And as soon as we were locked in, the mask fell, as they always do. And within 10 months, I had filed for divorce. So I was trying to, it took me a couple years to leave him. And so by the time I did leave, I had a one-year-old and my daughter was 4, and went back to school, was working, never got any child support, but I hustled and I was representing myself. I afforded an attorney. I got that attorney. I was going through this process, and then I needed a restraining order.
Why did you need a restraining order? I'm curious about that.
Because it was suggested to me by an attorney who saw the facts of the case, and she was like, you're going to meet the legal threshold. You don't actually need me to do this for you. You should do it yourself. And she was right. I did get it. It was made permanent. And that was like the first time I think I had not just anyone, but a judge believe me. And it was really, I remember I went in the hallway and I threw up in a trash can, because I was like, oh my God, I'm believed. Like, somebody believes how bad it is. And that was so monumental for my self-esteem, because I was coming out of a relationship where I was just, it was dehumanizing. And so by the time I did leave, I'd been trying to leave for a couple of years, for 2 years. Oh, I mean, it wasn't linear. You know, like, these things aren't linear. It's never, you don't just wake up one day and you decide, I'm leaving now, I'm going to do it today, and this is it. But when my ex-husband was arrested for violating that restraining order and stalking, they bumped it up to his felony stalking case. And but talk about dating apps. I had a dating app prior to the arrest and the criminal case starting that I hadn't checked in months. And I remember telling a girlfriend at the time, I was like, I don't want to meet anyone here because I'll get stuck in Colorado. I don't want to stay here. And I matched with someone. It popped up on my thing who I didn't recognize. And it was my current husband. And so I didn't know he was working in the DA's office where my ex-husband was being prosecuted. And so I met him and I figured out who he was. I told him right away. I said, I am a victim in this case. This is a bad idea. And he brought the relationship to the attention of the elected DA, who said, this is fine. This is a non-issue. Just don't rub it in your ex-husband's face. It was like a ticking time bomb. And it was. Because, as you can imagine, that once the defense found out about it, that did not look so good. So it was kind of a scandal.
What was, and I may have missed it, what was your ex-husband charged with that he was acquitted of?
They downgraded it to protective order violations. They didn't want to go to a felony trial, so they brought it back down to misdemeanors, and he walked on that. It was a six-person jury, five men, and he walked. Which, that part to me, to answer your question, how was that? That was so shocking because I had felt like the DA's office promised me an outcome and made it sound so, such a sure thing. I remember my family law attorney was surprised that that wasn't a conviction because of how it seemed so, just such a shoo-in. And that was really, it was kind of earth shattering because I thought I'm going to get justice. And I never did.
So how did, if it did, the acquittal affect your family law case?
You know, that's an interesting question. It did because actually during the course of the criminal case, we have one daughter together. My ex-husband never saw our daughter. He didn't want to. He didn't want to participate in parenting time, even though he had it. To answer your question, my ex refused to see our daughter for the duration of that trial. And he didn't take a plea. So he waited to trial. He didn't see her. And I think the judge wanted to see how that played out. And he still continued to not want to see her. And so in the end, I was awarded sole decision making, majority custody. He got like two alternating overnights a month. So two nights a month, indefinitely, no step up plan. That was the final order. And I married my husband. He looked at me and he was like, do you want to get married? And so we eloped and he actually adopted my eldest daughter from a previous relationship, the baby I had in college, who's now 10 and a half. She's in fourth grade. And there were just so many moving parts.
Tell me this. How did you know that your current husband was the green flags and not what you had done before?
Because he was unfamiliar in a way that what I was used to was a certain type of person, a certain type of guy. And I probably wouldn't have even given him the time of day, I think, 10 years ago. He was candid and humble and could make fun of himself. And I remember when I met him and he told me he was a prosecutor, I didn't believe him. I actually thought he was a defense attorney or a public defender because he had such a bleeding heart for his defendants. And I thought, you're in the wrong line of work. You should not be a deputy district attorney. You're just a nice person. And this picture behind me, this framed picture, to go back to when you said, how do you know this guy's different? His mother, she was a PhD. She had her doctorate. She was a professor. She was a single mom. She raised him. She ended up passing away when he was 12, but he had a reverence for women. And he grew up in a Southern family of very vivacious, outspoken, a little controversial women. I mean, to come from a small rural town in Arkansas and go get your PhD.
That's a big deal.
Right. And she got rid of her accent. I mean, and she raised him to believe he could do things. And he went to law school and he got out of here and he came back. But in contrast, my first husband grew up in a religious cult where women weren't even allowed to go on birth control. And they had so many children that his mother ended up dying in childbirth. I mean, like the contrast was motherhood literally killed my first husband's mother. Like, becoming a mom is what ended her life. So he had this view of that women and mothers should martyr themselves, literally. And I think, and I asked him once, I go, who are you comparing me to? Like, you know, you're always putting me down or telling me I'm a bad mom. Who are you comparing me to? And he's like, well, my mom. And I'm thinking, well, your mom's dead. Your mom, motherhood cost her her life. So I was competing with it. I mean, it was so, so dark. And then to marry someone who came from a totally different value system of education and women in education. And it was just so night and day. And that was one of the things that stood out to me when I met him, was he heard that I have the social media platform and he's like, there's something there. Let's do something with that. I think that's going to be big for you. And so just to know that he believed in me was refreshing.
My father actually told me that every woman in professional schooling was a wasted space for a man because men can work harder than women always. That was one of the things he told me.
My husband told me that.
Your ex-husband did?
My ex-husband used to tell me that every woman in a position of power or in business or in government or anything, she either slept her way to the top or it was handed to her by her father or something like that. And I remember telling that to my mother's sister, who is she was a VP of Comerica Bank in Detroit, never had kids. She was a career woman. And I said that to her, I go, yeah, he said this. And she looked at me and she goes, does he know that, like, what? No one gave me. I mean, like, it was just, we couldn't believe that someone said those things out loud, let alone believed them. And raising two daughters, I remember thinking, oh, I can't, I don't know how I made this choice of this person, but I could put up with a lot of things in my relationship, but I just looked at my girls and I was like, I don't want you to grow up thinking so little of yourself because your dad thinks so little of you.
Right. Right. And I think what was the other one they told me was after I already had two kids, but that I had to choose between being a mother or being a professional. I couldn't be both.
How important is that when you, both of you, have a partner that wants you to outshine them, wants you to create something that they have nothing to do with other than wanting to support you and basically give you the respect that you deserve? Not even just support, but the actual respect in that. What does that mean to you both?
I'll let Emily go first.
I think that I'm the first person in, like, my family in 100 years to actually have a husband who believes that. And I think about all the women before me who didn't have that. And I mean, I can look back, like, through my matrilineal heritage. 100 years ago, literally 100 years ago, my maternal line, my first ancestor in the United States from Poland, she was a single mom with two little girls. And when she was 26 years old, just like I was, she divorced her abusive husband. This was back in the 1920s in Detroit. She didn't speak English. She's from Poland. She rolled cigars. That was her job in Metro Detroit. And I think that woman struggled so much and she just wanted to raise her kids. She remarried a couple times. I mean, there's a lot of similarities. And I was like, oh, wow, this is so crazy. Like, I'm the first person in my line to have to get divorced. First of all, to be able to choose divorce and have my life improve in many ways, but also to end up married to someone who has not only, like, just said he wants to see me succeed, but has financially made that happen and, you know, helped me, just who's supported me in a way that no woman in my family has experienced or had experienced ever. So that was really significant, especially for my girls to see that.
It's so important for, and I think it applies to male children and female children, for them to see their mom being respected and their mom not being put on a pedestal, but someone saying, your mom is worthy and I'm going to show you she's worthy. That's a couple of things. One, it teaches your daughters how to expect to be treated, which is amazing, because they look to father figures to help them for their own identity, right? And what they should expect from a man. And then your sons learn how to treat women from the example of how their mother was treated. And so it is so valuable to have someone like your husband that's stepping in and and showing all the kids that it's your mom's a rock star and I'm going to support her. You're going to support her. And as a family, that's what we do. I mean, it's phenomenal.
I do think that, you know, I think it's interesting that I didn't have sons with my first husband, but I had two boys with my current husband. And I think that is, I mean, this new one only 2 weeks old, not even. I do think that that's interesting. Like God or the universe or whoever knew that we needed to have these boys to raise them into really good, strong men who respect women. And that's something that he says all the time. I mean, he was saying before we had him, because we waited to find out the sex of this baby, which I'd never done before. And
yeah,
he would talk about,
that.
You know, I did it with the other three. I found out, but this one, I was like, I just want to wait. But he would, you know, in talking about this leading up to the birth, my husband would say, I hope it's a boy because I really want to raise a strong boy. I want to raise a boy who had it better than I did. And, you know, it just seems like divinely guided. Like, of course we had two boys. Of course I had two boys with him because finally I have a husband who I want my sons to grow up and emulate. And I never had that before.
Well, it's wonderful. But Jake, I think to your question of what is it like to have a supportive partner? It's night and day different. And I don't think, at least from my perspective, that I realized what an actual level of support was until the last, I don't know, couple years, last year for sure. But I don't know that I ever really understood what it was to really support your wife or your girlfriend. And it's a little unnerving for me. Like, I'm still trying to get used to just some of the basics, which sounds odd, but it's like, have you eaten today? You talking to me? No, what you need to eat. Like, I actually called my paralegal this week and said, please make sure she eats. Night and day different.
You know, I got to tell you is that, you know, one of the things both of you that I take away from your messaging is that in order to get and feel that support, people have to respect you. And I think when we enter into these relationships, and even you were mentioning this, Emily, like a very long family tree, like centennial style approach, is it's not just society that necessarily mandates or dictates certain roles. It's within the family and it's certain mm-hmm. level of that. Like you can be oppressed, repressed. You can have a lot of things going wrong in the world. But if your world is your family and your family is your home, and in your home, you're not getting that regardless of what's going on outside, that's where things break down. And we've had this discussion many times where you get yourself into situations where you really want to believe the best in your partner and you really want to create some sort of atmosphere that you hope they'll eventually come around and see the value in you that you know to be true. And you know, but you have to get out of a bad relationship to recognize that because you're suppressed so much by the negativity and the toxicity of those conditions.
100%.
Jake, are you from California?
No, oddly enough, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri originally.
Okay. I could tell you were Midwestern.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. You can tell, right?
I'm from Michigan. So I'm like,
There you go. All right. I've been to Michigan quite a bit. Yeah, actually.
Yeah, no, it's definitely Midwesterner is definitely different. Like you can take the person out of the Midwest, but not the Midwest out of the person.
Right.
Michelle thought I was like an LA douchebag when we first met. But,
that is.
No, you said, you're driving around in your convertible. Basically, the tropes that you can imagine. But Michelle, when we first started working together, she was a guest on Strictly Talking, oddly enough. That's how we first met. Over 2 years ago. And it was Love Less Law at First Sight. Get it? Anyway.
Ba-dum-bum.
My Midwest roots, two things, Emily, and I'll tell you real quick to not sidetrack this, but I was raised primarily by women. Okay. I have three younger sisters, mom, grandma, great grandma, aunts. It was me and my dad sort of as the isolated males in this condition. Two things I want to mention. One, my dad has never said one disrespectful thing about a woman, like ever, that I've ever heard. Two, he knew that the strength of the women was the value and what was going to hold the family together. The women never emasculated us at all. We knew two things. We knew one is that we'd always get a voice, and two, everybody was equal. There was never a moment where it was like, hey, you know, there was no man versus woman. There was no gender interplay. Now, granted, we were outnumbered, let's be fair, physically and otherwise. I mean, everybody, the women kind of controlled the roost. Your current husband had a very strong woman as a role model who also supported him. She didn't bring
many women. Yeah.
They didn't bring the gender battle into the home. What they did is, I'm going to raise a strong, caring, supportive man who's going to go out in the world and treat women with the respect they deserve. That's something that needs to be discussed more often. And that's something it's very fortunate for your sons that you have that now, because it's very important for them to see a man respecting women, because we're in a society now, there's too many toxic things, especially online, where young men are being indoctrinated with things that are not healthy, not for themselves or not for any other women out there. And it doesn't have to be a battle, but I think men have taken that mantle on in a way like, well, let's just go back to how things were. The problem is that, you know, we're not there anymore. You can't reverse what's happened.
You can't put the genie back in the bottle.
No. Yeah. And I also think that women too, a lot of times, you know, when I got married, I didn't like announce an engagement or anything. And there were a lot of women who were disappointed in me for remarrying and for trying again. They were like, why would you? I mean, they're still also, I think the reason was they wanted to believe that happiness and joy can be found in choosing to never get back into a romantic relationship with a man. And this, the man bashing, I think was so, and I hate that phrase, but it is true. Like the, you know, F all men. And why would you risk, why would you do it again and try again? And why would you ever remarry? And like, you're not as jaded as I am. Because I know that everyone's different. Like, and I genuinely wanted to try again and see if I could get it right. And I like to think that I did, but I wouldn't have been able to find that person and be open to that if I came at it abrasive and angry and resentful toward all men. I mean, I know what the data says and what statistics say, but I also believe that there are really great guys out there who believe that it is their role to look out for women and protect women and use their privilege. I mean, my husband married me as a deputy district attorney the day after my abuser was found not guilty, in large part so that I would all of a sudden go from being just a vulnerable single mom to, well, now I'm the wife of an attorney and he's in law enforcement. And that was using his privilege to protect my family. And, you know, that was something that, like, talk about a man using his talent and his skills for good and not evil. I mean, that was just my favorite thing about him.
I'm curious, is how do people find you, number one, so they can get ask for help? And two, like, what's the vetting process that you have to determine who you give the help to?
Yeah, so we have a wonderful board of women from all backgrounds. We don't have a brick and mortar, so we can keep our overhead costs low. So our board members are all over the country. We have women we have an attorney in Montana. We've got women in Southern California. We've got a law enforcement wife. They're everyone from different backgrounds all over the country. We have a team of people who review these applications, and our criteria is we tend to be hands-off. I really don't actually want to know a lot of details. I personally don't need someone to divulge the most intimate traumas that they've experienced to be believed. Like, I you know, there's, and of course there's some risk with that. Like, someone might be dishonest. Frankly, it's not a lot of money we're going to lose if someone does try to lie to us, that I'm not like, oh, she wasn't being truthful. I'd rather take that risk in helping someone than making them feel dehumanized by trying to like prove to me that they're worthy of my help. But what was your original question? What did you ask me at the beginning? I'm sorry, I have baby brain.
Like, what do you take into consideration? That's okay. It happens to me all the time.
Okay.
Like, I'll be in court. I'm like judge, can I just start over? It's a no.
Right. What was I saying?
No, but what gets you to, like, when you get an applicant? I mean, first we'll talk about how they actually find you.
Oh, how they find me.
Right. How do they get to you to even start the process to apply for assistance?
Well, it's a lot of it's word of mouth. I'll say when I was just a homeschooling, homesteading, stay-at-home mom, I had a social media page that was growing slowly, but I talked about the things I was interested in, which a lot of other stay-at-home moms are interested in: breastfeeding, home birth, homesteading, homeschooling. And that, you know, I created kind of an identity for myself of this is what I value. And those women who share those same values, a lot of them tend to be in financially abusive relationships, just like I was. And so now we'll get applications from women that don't follow me or don't know who I am, but someone they know did. And so my name will pop up in Facebook groups or in local divorce pages, or I'll see the Mama Wilder Foundation tagged in lots of posts where someone's like, oh, I see you need help. Why don't you apply for this grant? So it's like just spoken word, women telling each other, hey, this resource exists. You should look into it.
So tell me this, because you said something that triggered me. Why is it that you believe, or if you know, that women that are the homesteaders and the stay-at-home moms are the ones that are really in these abusive relationships? That was a really curious statement. So I'm like, well, let's talk about that. What are your thoughts on that?
This subject actually inspired me to go back to school and study women's studies, because I was not studying women's studies when I started out. I was like in college Republicans and grew up in a military family. I would never in a million years like study women's studies. But I went back to school throughout my divorce to study just on a systemic level, how women are treated in the healthcare system and in the legal system. And there's this connotation or just assumption that women, you know, women's work is devalued, as you know, and to be taken seriously as a woman and be believed, you have to work twice as hard as men. I mean, any man can, what the traits that you are probably given a lot of flack for, your male counterpart is not. He's a guy being a guy. So, and I've seen that now, having spent so much time in court myself, that women are just shafted. And so I think when women are stay-at-home moms, I don't think I know this. First of all, they don't have many resources when they're not actually earning income, and they don't have many options. And money is freedom. And when a woman doesn't have her own income or her own access to money, or even if she's not working, if her husband's not funding an account in her name that she can have full control over, she doesn't have many options. And so a lot of the women that I have encountered, especially, I think the bulk of, I did a Substack on this, actually. I analyzed the data in the beginning of the year for our applications and ran it through a software. And I learned that most of the women are stay-at-home moms. They're women who really value being home with their children. They don't want to go get careers. They're not career women. Or they're in that phase of life where they're home with their little babies and they might have a career on pause. But that is inherently vulnerable. They're inherently at a disadvantage because they just don't have money. And that's when a lot of the abuse pops up. I mean, I'm sure you know that pregnancy and postpartum are two of the times in a woman's life where she's most likely to figure out she's in an abusive relationship, because her partner's like, I don't need to try anymore. She's locked in. I can abuse her and exploit her. What's she going to do, leave me? Yeah, right. So I saw that firsthand. And it's almost been echoed in all these applications we see. And it's almost redundant. Like, I don't want to minimize anyone's plight, but it's like so textbook cookie cutter, these stories of like, you know, he told me I should stay home and he would support me. And then all of a sudden I don't have a phone because he disconnected it and our credit cards shut off. And it's like, how do they all begin the same way? It's this promise of I'll take care of you, you can be home with your kids. And then one day they wake up and really it's like I'm up Schitt's Creek without a paddle.
So then I guess the next question for me comes in with, then are the women that want to be the stay-at-home moms, do they make themselves more of a target for these abusers because they let them know early on in the dating relationship, hey, I want to be a stay-at-home mom? I mean, does that put a big bullseye on them?
I think it did for me, to be honest. I was actually a single mom when I met my ex-husband. And I remember having a conversation early on with him about how I really valued being home with my toddler. And he said, oh yeah, I think that's so important. I think, you know, his brother had had a child recently and we were talking about their dynamic. And he really seemed to value the same things. And I think, I wonder now, you know, years later, did I give myself away by saying that so early on? Did I let him know that I would be a prime target? But at the same time, I think, you know, too, we see women who are ambitious career women who are strong and vivacious and bold, and they're still targeted by these vultures and vampires. You know, it's, I don't know. It's something I think about too. Like, how do you not make yourself a target? But at the same time, how do you arrive to a relationship as your authentic self and not also risk becoming a victim?
Yeah, it's almost like it's, one, it's a catch 22, and two, there's almost no winning it. Like, no matter what you do, you're at risk for it. Oh, have you used co-parenting? Like the co-parenting apps, like Our Family Wizard? I use Our Family Wizard, and most of the courts order Our Family Wizard. You can say, well, that's nice tone meter, but I'm still sending the message that says F you, you MF-er, and I hate you, and I hope you crawl back into your spider hole, shrivel up, and die. That's actually a message.
That sounds like it was shared from our group chat on the Locks.
Probably. I think that's one you sent me, actually.
You know, I'm very careful with what I send, but I'm also not a lawyer. I would think that a lawyer would have a little more discretion when they send 3 a.m. text on a company feed, but that's just me. I'm just, call me traditional, you know, sort of a small town mentality, I guess. I live in Los Angeles, so.
Right. So, and Jake is a fat, was it?
Fat.
Fat, no, not fat. Fast-footed, fancy-free. What's the term? I always get it wrong.
Are you talking about? Sorry.
Footloose and fancy-free.
Footloose and fancy-free. Yeah.
There
we go.
There you go. It came to me. And so he doesn't have any animals or kids, and he's currently single.
Can't wait.
You are an animal. That's right.
Sorry, Emily. This is.
So his hours that he maintains are that of a bachelor. He can do whatever he wants till 1 a.m., 2 a.m. I go to bed like 9:30, 10. If I'm up past 10 o'clock, we're going to have a problem the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but because I'm perimenopause, I wake up 3 o'clock, somewhere between 2 and 4, just depending on the day. And I know I can text him and get a response. Up. Right? So it sounds all scandalous, like, oh my God, you're sending messages at 3 a.m.? I'm like, it could not be anything further from scandal.
You're up for different reasons.
Correct. Yes,
it's not salacious, but the vulgarity meter, I don't know if, you know, I know Our Family Wizard has a meter, but we don't at Lockstar Media. So my concern, Emily, is that these texts, and I thought about this from a very early age when digital media came out, is none of this goes away, right? Your digital footprint or things like that, right? And technically, none of this is defamatory towards Michelle, her being, or her ability to pass the bar when she's up for review, which happens every 2 weeks, as you can imagine. when you do a podcast and you're, you know, as vivacious as Michelle, you're going to have moments where your credibility is going to be challenged, right? And you know that she battles every single day in the court. But the Achilles heel may be our text thread. So I just want to put that out there.
It may
just
be.
So I have it on tape. That's it. So
it may be. There are some, it's entertaining. And I use the F word more than I probably should. In fact, I listened to one of our recordings previously and I was like, Jake, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but can you edit out all the bad words? I was like, it's got to go.
You'd think, like, you come to this podcast and you think, well, I've got a baby. We're going to have to stop down. Your baby is only helping us move further along faster because we know you've got a life and priorities. So I'm just
life and priorities.
Yeah. When the 2.5-year-old wakes up, it's over, man.
Oh, we're done. We're done.
For all of us.
See, Michelle. All right. Sorry. I'll be quiet.
Because he doesn't shut up.
Emily, I am curious, where did the name Mama Wilder come from?
Well, Wilder is my eldest middle name because when I was a college student and trying to figure things out, I really, I was like just down a rabbit hole one day of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, she was pretty instrumental in popularizing the libertarian movement back in the day, but she was this like, she didn't have kids. She was, and this was like, over 150 years ago, maybe, right? I don't know. That doesn't make sense. It has to be. Anyway, she was like she traveled the world. She was a journalist. She wrote about really controversial issues for her time. And I was like, oh, I love that. And now my maiden name is Rose. So Rose is not just my middle name. It's my birth name. Emily Rose is the name I was born with. And so my daughter, her last name is Rose, and I liked the Wilder Rose together. And so like Rose Wilder. Anyway, that's where that came from. And so when I just started blogging about my motherhood journey when I was in my early 20s, and it was just Mama Wilder was the brand name. And then last summer, I just dropped Mama Wilder from my social media page, and I just became Emily. I became who I am. So like my Substack and all that is just Emily Rose Chavik, because I just want to be able to be more Googleable. Like, and kind of, you know, the nonprofit is its own thing. I do my thing. I don't like make money from the nonprofit. Nobody makes money from the nonprofit, but I'm my own entity. So Wilder, we just stuck with it for the 501c3, because that whole idea of like women's independence, that always just really appealed to me.
When you look at what do you want the future to be? Because we're in a climate now where there's a lot of programs that are being decimated. There's a lot of things out there that people can't get the support they need.
It's like, as long as I'm still able to speak, there'll still be money coming in for this platform. And one of the things too, I think because I have more of a, I'll just be honest, a more conservative audience, most of the women who are interested in homeschooling, homesteading, breastfeeding, stay-at-home mom stuff, they tend to be more right-leaning. And when I started talking about how I went back to school and got a degree in women's studies, they were like, oh my God, she's drinking the Kool-Aid. And I'm like, no, I think this is all relevant to what we're all experiencing. I don't think that learning about feminism is really that controversial. But I translated it to so many other areas like healthcare and obstetrics and, you know, in the birth world too. And so it's like, as long as I can talk about those other issues I'm passionate about, there's still money coming in for the nonprofit. But also that speaks to that sense of community, because those women still find my page in those circles. And I also just happen to know of a nonprofit that if you need some help, you can ask for some cash assistance and someone will just send it to you and not have to make you like, you know, reveal yourself to prove your worthiness. And so it's like it's its own self-sustaining thing. Like my husband, when we moved here, he started his own 501c3 to clean up this community, because it's a very rural, impoverished community. And we just talk about like, how is that going to be funded? There's no social media name attached to that. So it's, you have to take that into consideration. Like, I come with my own funding source. Other nonprofits, they might rely on grants, you know, money from the government. We don't. And that's honestly such a blessing. And because of my, I guess, like situation on social media, other creators with bigger platforms have donated to our nonprofit because they know that is something. It's like just, I have a vehicle for these people to help other women. And a lot of these women they're helping are their own audience members. So like we had a really big, a woman in the health space who donated a lot of money to the nonprofit just because she knew that her audience and my audience are pretty overlapping and there's some need there. And so that I like having this avenue for people to use to, if they want to give back to women, as you know, from creator to creator, that's there. And because this is, like I said, the stay-at-home mom demographic is so, there is a lot of exploitation and a lot of abuse that goes on. And I think a lot of these women also don't want to confront that.
Well, they don't want to confront it because they don't want to be left with nothing, because that's the perception. The perception is that they say anything that they'll be left basically destitute, because I'm sure the person they're with has convinced them over however many years that you can't live without me, you won't be able to survive without me, you won't be able to make ends meet without me. And they do. They'll either limit the credit card, they'll limit the line of credit, they'll shut it off, they'll put it on for 2 hours and then shut it off when you're out somewhere. I mean, it's a constant game. And how do they get the money to go pay a retainer for an attorney? Like, even if they are a successful family, they're still stuck at the whim of what their spouse is allowing them to happen, right? You don't know what their spouse is going to allow to happen with regards to funds. They don't have separate credit cards. They've got joint credit cards. They've got stuff where the husband or the other significant other sees all of the finances and all of the spending. And so you can't hide anything. And they've got typically little kids at home. and they've not been in the workforce, and or they've been out of the workforce for a period of time. And so they are truly, they feel stuck. And what are they going to do next? I mean, it really is a problem. Well, I suspect you're going to have a two-year-old waking up here pretty soon because I heard you turn and listen. I know the cues.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't pick that one up.
Here, little feet.
Oh, I did. Oh, I did.
Too busy living my bachelor life in Los Angeles, Michelle.
I saw the cues. I was like, oh, we got to wrap this up. Right. So, Emily, where can our audience find you?
I am on Instagram. My name, Emily Rose Chadwick, very easy to find. I'm on Substack too. I write a lot about my experience. I just wrote about my birth story, navigating the healthcare system. And I talk about how that has to do with family court. My baby is spitting up. But Instagram's the best way. Instagram's the best way. That's where the nonprofit, we also have the nonprofits on Instagram, but then the MamaWilderFoundation.org is how.
Well, I'm going to do the outro so that you can put yourself on mute and go. Thank you so much for joining us. But I saw the head turn. I was like, oh, she's got one that's getting up.
But for Baby's First Podcast, Michelle, can we send this to Emily's son?
Oh, yes, we sure can.
And then as he grows up, you can tell him this is your first podcast. It's like,
he's going to get such a kick out of it. Yeah. At 11 days old.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us on today's Love, Lust, Law. We loved having Emily here. If you are looking to find out more about me and what I'm up to, you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok at Attorney Michelle Locke. You can also find me at YouTube as well. You can tune into our podcast, Love, Lust, Law, wherever you find your podcasts, and also video now on YouTube. You can also email me at hello@michellelocke.com. Just remember, Michelle is with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that. Have a great one.